Revolution 1989 in East Germany. A little bit of background to it. The history of the Communist Party in Germany obviously is related to that, and the history of the Cold War in general, the conflict between East and West, the conflict between the Soviet Union and the West. So just a rushed background to that. Obviously the 1918 revolution was decisive for dividing the Social Democratic Party into the revolutionary tendencies, which created a workers' republic, a council republic, a republic of Soviets. Then the Independent Social Democratic Party was created. The Social Democratic Party betrayed the revolution, killed Rosa Luxemburg and Liebknecht. The Communist Party had a bit of an ultra-left position at the time. After the death of Rosa Luxemburg and Liebknecht, there was a period of crisis, 3, 4, 5 years of crisis, up until 1923, when the Communist Party lost their opportunity to seize power, and the movement basically lost their chance. Even in spite of that, the Communist Party grew very rapidly during that period, but not as rapidly, particularly after 1929, not as rapidly as the Nazi Party. The Nazi Party came to power, crushed the Communist movement and the Social Democratic movement, although sections of the trade unions and the Social Democratic apparatus, sections of them, obviously not the decisive sections, but some sections went over towards the Nazis. Also, some Communist Party activists went over towards the Nazis, of course, because they controlled the state, and you basically had to make a choice. You know, how are you going to go into the underground or abroad, or are you going to remain in the country? Now, the key leadership of the Communist Party went abroad, first of all, either to France or to Czechoslovakia, and then to the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, Stalin's policy shifted depending upon his relationship to Hitler and the West, basically, because of the Spanish Civil War and so on. They changed their position according to that. And then after the defeat, or the obviousness of the defeat of the Spanish Civil War, Stalin made an agreement with Hitler temporarily to try and divide up Poland and Eastern Europe, with the intention of, if you like, holding off the threat which Hitler would pose. And some people say, obviously, that Hitler wanted to attack the Soviet Union. Stalin should have known that. And there's disputes about whether or not his position was that they would attack. As some people say, he was completely surprised when they attacked. Other people think that he knew they were going to attack. Inside the Soviet Union during the war, the first phases of the war, the Germans inside the Soviet Union, including the Communist Party activists who had fled in 19, there were millions of supporters of the Communist Party up until 1933. Many had fled to the Soviet Union, and these were the core cadre of the people who came back to Eastern Germany at the end of the Second World War and created the new party. I'll go into that in a little while. Walter Ulbricht was the leader of the Communist Party at the time in the Soviet Union. Walter Ulbricht was pretty much an apparatchik man. He went to Stalingrad during the Battle of Stalingrad, just after the Battle of Stalingrad, addressed the German soldiers with the intention of winning over the key cadre of the German war sections, particularly the officer corps. That was their intention, to win over a layer who would act as a sort of agents of Stalin at the end of the Second World War. The intention was to divide up Europe once they believed they were going to defeat Hitler. Stalin's intention was to divide up Europe, and Germany was to be the dividing point, and he would use Germany as a pawn in the international game to gain a certain position of authority vis-a-vis the Western world, have buffer states to protect them against the threat from the West. Germany, and after Stalingrad and the Battle of Kursk, the Soviets marched relatively unhindered towards the West and eventually arrived in Berlin. They arrived in Austria first, then they arrived in Berlin. Austria was divided into four occupying powers: France, Britain, and the United States and Soviet Union. Vienna was divided into four zones. Inside the Soviet zone, I can't quite remember about Vienna. And Eastern Germany, what later became Eastern Germany, was effectively conquered by the Soviets. Not entirely the same territory. Some Americans moved back, Soviets moved forward in some parts. And Berlin was divided into four zones: the Americans, the British, the French, and the Soviet zone. It was not quite the same as in the other Eastern European countries, because the other Eastern European countries was quite clear that Stalin wanted to establish some sort of client state, some sort of Stalinist regime would take over. The Red Army had control of the weapons, and they would give weapons to people like in Czechoslovakia, to give weapons to those supporters of theirs. They would make a party or a series of parties and a coalition of parties, which were people who had supposedly anti-fascists. So anybody who wasn't a fascist, the same sort of thing as in Spain in a way, but with the state apparatus under the control of the Stalinists, the army and police, you know, is the famous 2 ministries which they needed to control in order to control the state apparatus, control the destiny of the country, of the regions, if you like. East Germany was a little bit different to that. East Germany had... The intention was first to unify the Social Democratic Party and the Communist Party together, on the basis that the activists who remained inside Germany and those who had been Social Democratic supporters before Hitler came to power, that they would feel a desire for unity. And so the Communist Party and Social Democrats were welded together. Now, they welded together in a bureaucratic fashion. They didn't actually, in the Western zones, obviously the Americans and the British had an interest in trying to prevent this process, and so they lent on the right wing of social democracy. In the Eastern zones, the social democratic apparatus, obviously feeling the weight of Stalinist apparatus, but also because they felt a genuine desire for unity, advocated unification. So you had a different process in East and Western Germany. In Western Germany, Western sectors of Germany, better said, the American, British and French sector as opposed to the Soviet sector, they voted against unifying the two parties, and in the Eastern sector they voted in favour. At that time the elections were, at least in 1945-46, the elections were still relatively free and fair, as you can say, in Western terms, although obviously the Westerners were screaming and shouting because in the East they had control of the ideological apparatus and the schooling and the weapons and so on and so forth, and the same in the West, and the Soviets accused them as well. This continued, this accusation and counter-accusation about who was carrying out what policies and who was, you know, who was genuinely democratic and all that sort of thing, of course, continued right up until 1961. Until 1961, so from 45 until 61, you could still freely move around Berlin. In other words, you could leave the East if you wanted to. Now, that's quite distinct from the other countries. The other countries of Eastern Europe, you know, you were effectively there, you know, and you couldn't really get away. The Soviets did have a repressive regime in the sense that they would arrest opponents, certainly up until Stalin's death. 1953, he died. But they would arrest opponents on the basis of being Nazis. You know, they would say they're Nazis or they're Nazi supporters, and that was the basis upon which the regime in Eastern Germany was established. It was a regime, as I said, originally created in the Soviet Union. They gathered together in the Soviet Union a layer of particularly military personnel, but also capable individuals within the prisoner of war camps who came back into eastern sectors of Germany and created the basis for a regime which they established in Eastern Germany, based on the army, based on the former Communist Party, based on sections of the Social Democrats, the trade unions, which then became the administrators and the determiners of everything, you know, control decisions, everything like this, would be made by bureaucrats. And of course, a lot of them were believers in communism because they had a very long tradition of communist and Marxist ideas in Germany, and they believed they were creating this sort of better Germany. That was the sort of idea on which they founded their state. In the West, of course, there were many people who were Nazis from the old regime who incorporated into the state apparatus in the West, and that was used by the Easterners as an argument as to what the regime is in the West. They said it was just a continuation of Nazism, it's a Nazi regime, and their people, they're creating a better Germany, and their people are in a new type of society. And there was obviously an enormous amount of enthusiasm on a large section of the population for that regime. However, there were a lot of people who didn't like it. A lot of people didn't like being politicized, constantly having Marxism and Leninism shoved down their throat, or the sort of Stalinist version of it, and all the other typical characteristics of a Stalinist regime. You know, kids getting, you know, being taught about Lenin when they're 3 years of age and stuff like that. And going on parades and other people disappearing in the night in the 1950s. You know what I mean? There used to be a story about that, you know. How's that going again? Oh, I'll come up with it later. In the West, obviously, there was in Western sectors of Berlin. Berlin was the, if you like, decisive focal point for the Cold War, because precisely it was divided into these four sectors. You know, the Eastern sector over there, and you've got the British, the American, and the French sectors of the city. And these sectors were divided up initially by the Western powers. They were divided up, demarcated the zones of the city. And they would do checks on people, in particularly after the 1948. The Soviets blockaded the city because a new currency was introduced into Western sectors of Germany. The original idea was that Germany would be a unified entity and would have a single economic entity. After the Second World War, the victors would arrange that Germany would eventually have a... Initially, the idea was to deindustrialize Germany, weaken Germany. But after that, they changed the policy and began to have a policy of sort of developing Germany. The Stalinists wanted to take the resources of East Germany to the Soviet Union to pay for reparations for the cost of the Second World War. And the Americans eventually decided this was too dangerous because Europe was unstable. Western Europe might lean towards communism. Obviously, the French Communist Party very strong, Italian Communist Party very strong. And there was also a mood of discontent even in the American army at the time. Consequence of that is that they put a lot of resources into Western Europe, the Marshall Aid Plan and so on, and they developed Western Germany and began to create an independent state in the West. So contrary to popular opinion, popular sort of knowledge, actually it was the West that broke away. West created an independent state in the Western sectors of Germany, and then the conflict zone became Berlin. Would Berlin be part of a united Germany, which would be neutral, demilitarized? Originally, the idea was deindustrialized, but that was out of the question by that time, by the 1950s. Anyway, the Western sectors introduced a new currency. There was effectively a new state created. East did the same thing. And by 1948, there were two states created at that time. Of course, there was also the threat of nuclear war in the air. A lot of the Westerners wanted to bomb the East, and this sort of atmosphere continued right up until the 1960s, this sort of constant threat of nuclear war, which of course created a certain psychology. When you imagine the sort of situation of the communists in Berlin, they felt on the front line state, they used to call it, you know, the front line city or the front line state. And this was a sort of mentality that created, of course, also the psychology that justified Stalinist repression, because you would be able to, you know what I mean, you know, someone's, you know, got some pro-Western views and perhaps they're regularly going across to the West. They might also, for example, be going across, if you walk to, you know, literally just across the road over here, you'd be in the West. And if you go across to the West there, you could earn, you know, if you live in the East, you might get subsidized housing. You might only be paying like £5 a month in house, in rent. Across the road, you pay £50 a month, but you can earn £200 a month over there, and over here in the Eastern currency, which was about 1 to 5 of the Western currency, you would earn, you know, one tenth of that in your income. And so, if you went across to the West, then you could earn a lot of money and come back here and come back to the East, live like a king, you know, and that would have an effect upon the economy. So, therefore, acts like that were considered to be sabotage by the official Communist Party, by the apparatus, if you like, by the bureaucracy. Consequence of that is there's this dual economy. The dual economy obviously was the base upon which people would say, you know, this is sabotage, you're a traitor, you're a counter-revolutionary, whatever else it would be. They would hold some show trials and that sort of thing. And also inculcate into the population into the loyalists within the population, but also the rest of the population, that this was counter-revolutionary activity, that this was, a bourgeois influence and all this sort of thing. And eventually, came to a head with the building of the Berlin Wall. 1953 was an uprising. The uprising had contradictory elements to it. After Stalin died, there was an uprising. 16th, 17th of June, workers came out on strike, demanded a reduction in work norms. The government agreed to give that. The reduction in work norms meant that... But the movement escalated beyond that, and sections of the population began to demand free elections. They also demanded... some demanded unification. There certainly were some areas where the Communist Party and Communist Party activists were sort of leading or at least supporting the movement. There were other areas where there probably were Nazi elements involved in it. I met one officer from the army who was, he woke up in Moscow after he'd been beaten up by the protesters, and he said, I said, well, what evidence is that? Well, he said, I know there were Nazis, he said, because we put them there. We put them in the factories in the worst conditions, in the worst parts of the factories as a punishment. And therefore, these people, when the economic conditions, of course, were not as great as in the West, and had that as a comparison just next door, then they, you know, they became, if you like, it by default became sometimes in some areas leaders of the opposition movement. Consequence of that was there was after 1953 some relaxation of the oppression, but you could always run away still. You know, people left, about 2.6 million people left before 1961, so 45 to 61. 2.6 million people left East Germany, 17 million inhabitants. So you get an idea, these are decisive sections of the workforce that were leaving. Skilled workers, industrial workers, those who could get jobs in the West were often left. So that's the background to building the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was built in 1961 at the time when the Soviets were sending a man to space, and it looked like there was this huge progress in society. The building of the Berlin Wall was presented in East Germany as, if you like, a stopgap measure to stabilize the regime while they prepare for communism. Communism was supposed to come in 20 years' time. Everyone was supposed to have the highest living standard, the richest culture, and so on and so forth by 1980. That was the official line of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in the summer of, in 31st of July 1961, they proposed that as their long-term plan. After 1961, there was a certain relaxation inside East Germany. Once the Berlin Wall was built, the West, of course, threatened, gave a lot of huff and puff about the Berlin Wall, but actually they didn't do anything about the Berlin Wall. It sort of anchored and stabilized this relationship that existed from 1961 up until the late 1980s of the two worlds, basically, you know, facing each other, competing economically, you know, but with sealed off borders and the Cold War image, you know, from the spy who came into from the cold to James Bond. All these images are associated with Berlin, with the division of Germany, with East Germany, with West Germany, with the division of the world in one city where family members, friends, lovers were divided for 61 years in a city. You know, so they obviously went on about it. And in the West, this was always the big thing. You know, I mean, they lost their connection to the East. They're such inhuman monsters that they can build a wall and divide people up. And what sort of socialism is that? That's the one side to it. Obviously, they also lost their property. You know, most of the property owners from before the Second World War were obviously generally tended to have a relationship with the Nazis, and therefore they were the people who would scream loudest of all. But it wasn't just them. My family were not Nazis, but they had some little bit of property in the East, which they lost as well when they left and went to the West. And they went in 1947. But 1960s up until the 1980s, it was a relatively strong economy, quite a strong economy, a richer economy than Britain. Living standards were higher than Britain in the sense that housing, healthcare, education, all the sort of normal things that the Stalinists provided in Eastern Europe were provided for the population, but they also had a high level of skill, education, welfare rights, very, very strong. You couldn't lose your job. If you had problems, they would always help you out. You know, there was a relatively easy atmosphere at work. Living standards a little bit higher than Britain, but not as high as in West Germany. West Germany provided, there was a lot of money pumped into West Germany to make West Germany, obviously, as the front state of the West, to make it richer than the East. Anybody goes to West Germany, you'll see that even to this day, it's a very wealthy country, second or third economy in the world, very highly developed industrial technique, which obviously had consequences later on. Were East Germany next to Greece or next to Spain or something like that, the situation would have been slightly different at the end. One of the key elements, of course, was you couldn't travel. And because you couldn't travel to the West, better said. You couldn't travel to the West except with restrictions. The restrictions were imposed by the apparatus of the bureaucracy, which would, you know, check up on your family, your friends, who you know, why you know. You'd be interviewed, you get questioned. In the 1980s, it relaxed, particularly after 83, but and around, I think, 7 million people travelled to the West between 83 and, or more than that, between 83 and 89. But again, it was always with restrictions. You could go, one family member could go, but not every family member could go. And it was always this sort of angle that the Western powers and the Western media went on about, and the Western politicians went on about. But they didn't expect the situation to change. Really, firstly, the idea of change only came after Gorbachev came to power. Gorbachev himself said that the changes coming were, if you like, a reflection of what had happened in Poland. Either they changed from above, or they would be changed from below, and that might threaten everything. And that's why they tried to introduce some sort of change from above. 85, 86, when Gorbachev first came to power, he began to propose a greater openness and discussion. The Stalinists in East Germany refused to engage in that discussion. They said their economy was quite strong, which is quite true. It was strong compared with most of the other Stalinist countries, but it wasn't as strong as the West, and it had, you know, some fundamental things were lacking, particularly because of the lack of democratic control, the lack of participation. And participation has different elements to it. It's not just, of course, because there's a bureaucratic apparatus, because it loosened itself up, but because there isn't that activity from below. There's a sort of lethargy. You know, people would go to work. I went to one factory, for example, in 1989. There was a comrade there, went to the factory. First thing in the morning, you have a few beers. You know, before you, in the canteen, you know, they would serve beer, and you go to work, have a few beers. They offered me a job at a college, and I went to this job, you know, the first thing they do is, first thing in the morning, you meet, and this is all the sort of white collar workers. You know, you sit down and have tea and cakes. That's your starting point of your day, you know, which might sound quite nice, but it's actually not very productive in terms of doing anything at work. But they were quite efficient. You know, these are Germans, so there's a relative efficiency in the way they organise things, in spite of the fact that obviously this bureaucracy had a dead hand on the apparatus of the state and the industry and administration. But I mean, that sort of multiplies itself. They had like 250 combines that controlled the economy, which were quite well coordinated together. But you know, the computers were lower level than in the Western computers. They didn't have integrated networks, even though they had already been developed in the Soviet Union. They weren't applied. And because people weren't, you know, there was no fax machines. When I went to China in 89, there were fax machines. So you go to East Germany, no fax machines, no photocopiers. So if you wanted to copy something, you had to have one of these. Yeah, we used to use that in the 1980s, early 80s in England. You know, we used to use that for printing stuff. But you couldn't just write something up and go to a printer and print it. If it's a political thing or something that's not approved by the existing apparatuses of control in the printing of things, then, you know, you wouldn't get it approved, and you couldn't copy things, and the only copy is, even though they could have gone across to the West and bought those things, they didn't want those things available to people because they thought that would, you know, encourage, you know, dissent and disagreement. Having said that, there began to be tendencies even within the bureaucracy that began to have some openness, particularly with the Soviet Union changing. People looked towards the Soviet Union, particularly the intermediate layers in society, young people, students, layers of the bureaucracy that were lower levels of bureaucracy, lower levels in the sense of, you know, perhaps a teacher, a white-collar worker, a intellectual, that sort of classical dissident layer of the population within Eastern Europe. Began to question the way things were. A lot of people go around with Gorbachev badges in the late 80s and expect some democratizations, more openness, more discussion. There began to be a conflict about the fact that the Soviet press, which was published in Eastern Germany, most people read Russian, they also had German language translations of these things, and the Soviet press was eventually, some Soviet documents were published in November 88, which questioned the role of the East German of the Communist Party in relation to Hitler's coming to power, which of course undermined the authority of the Communist Party, who were all, not all, but a lot of them were, like Honecker, for example, who was the leader at the time. He was a former, you know, he spent 10 years in concentration camp, so his whole authority was based on the fact that he was an anti-Nazi and that he'd fought the Nazis and this sort of thing. And the Soviets were basically releasing information that was damaging to their credibility. This resulted in them banning some of the Soviet press, and that resulted in young people beginning to feel more and more enclosed by the situation, that nothing would change. Then the Hungarians opened the border in May 1989. That meant that East Germans who could travel to Hungary, some of them went across from Hungary across to the West. In the embassies in Prague and in Hungary, East Germans who were on holiday, some of them wanted to leave for whatever reason. The jump into the embassy. There were several thousand people, created internal crisis in the east. Some people began to assemble in September 1989 in Leipzig and Dresden around the churches. The churches always had a little bit more openness of discussion. Obviously, they had to allow the discussion to take place around spiritual issues, but they also had some people around there who were involved in discussing ecological issues, political issues. There was, for example, there was an Umweltblätter, which is environment leaflets, but the environment leaflets sometimes had things by Trotsky in there and stuff like that within church, and it said inner church discussion only. I've got a few of them at home. There's maybe, you know, they make 200 of these and circulate them to those people who were considered to be in the opposition, of whom probably a third were secret police agents. So you were basically surrounded by these secret police apparatus, which would observe those who were active. There weren't that many people active in the opposition. About 200 people were active in the opposition up until 1989. After 1989, the whole thing mushroomed. In the summer of 89, some people protested against the way things were in East Germany because they wanted to leave. Demonstration of a few hundred people who wanted to leave. And then other people began to protest, and they said, "Wir bleiben hier." So the slogan started out, the whole revolution started out, "Wir wollen raus, wir wollen raus, we want to leave, we want to leave." And then other sections began to take to the streets and say, "Wir bleiben hier, wir bleiben hier, we're staying here, we're staying here." In other words, they wanted to change East Germany, bring about a transformation of East Germany, democratize East German society. They created something called New Forum. New Forum was a sort of umbrella under which they intended to, within the structures of the state, legitimately challenge the way in which the party ruled, create more openness, like in the Soviet Union, openly discuss and debate, and engage in creating and transforming East German society. And it was East German society they were talking about. This created an enormous movement of support around... Well, I mean, literally the churches were packed out with people attending meetings, which were political meetings. They were not religious meetings. There people discussed what they wanted. What did they want? Of course, democratic control. Primarily on democratic issues it was, you know, democratic control, freedom of expression, freedom to choose what organizations you join or don't join, independent newspapers, independent press, genuine elections, that sort of thing. But they weren't at that stage, they were quite tentative, partly because they came from, these were a lot of the time people who had left the party or were still in the party, and they were very closely associated with the bureaucracy, with the way the regime operated, but also with the idea of socialism, because this was a state which had been founded by people who had chosen to remain, pretty much, and certainly up until 1961, other than the new generation, the younger people who were born in the system and raised in the system. So in order to cut short, long story short, the protests began to escalate, particularly in October, November 1989. By the 4th of November 1989, there was a huge demonstration of around 1 million people on the demonstration at Alexanderplatz. This created enormous internal pressure. Honecker, the leadership, were in desperate crisis. They, as distinct from the Western world, a crisis inside the Stalinist regimes tended to be an almost immediate crisis. As soon as people took to the street, the regime collapsed, gave everything, conceded everything. Of course, that's one of the difficulties in the Stalinist world, was that when everything's conceded to you, it's kind of difficult to formulate demands, because, you know, you demand something immediately, you demand something, give it, and it's, you know, you have to jump ahead of them. But they didn't jump ahead themselves all that much, but eventually they granted certainly sufficient concessions to stabilize, if you like, temporarily, a layer of the bureaucracy, or the lower levels of the bureaucracy, who would say, okay, let's have a bit of time to try and introduce these careful reforms and not rock the boat too much, otherwise everything would be upset. However, what they did was they opened the Berlin Wall to try and stabilize their position. The consequence of that was, of course, that it changed the mood on the demonstrations. The demonstrations initially had been demanding, you know, democratization of East German society, and that began to change. That was November the 9th, 1989, they opened the Berlin Wall. When people went to the West, they were obviously happy that they could go to the West first. A lot of, there's different reactions, of course, by different people. There was some bemusement by a lot of people, but also this sort of genuine celebration, the fact that they felt they'd achieved something, but also the fact they could go and see these different things they hadn't seen before and all that sort of thing. It was, you know, sort of strange atmosphere, and you've probably seen lots about it on television and so on. Most of that's distorted, though, however, because they'll give you this impression that everyone ripped down the wall with a pickaxe or something like that. But when you see the pickaxes, they're always attacking a wall that's coloured, which means they're attacking the wall on the west, not in the east. Doesn't mean they were in favour of the wall, but they didn't want to tear down the wall. That wasn't the idea. Certainly not in November 1989. By January, it was a little bit different. The movement began to split. It began to physically split. The demonstration split between those people who wanted, began to advocate. And it was from below that came, as well as from above, from the west, because the Western television, again, a distinction with most Eastern European countries, Western television was broadcast into the east. Right from the creation of television, you had television from the west broadcasting into the east, radio broadcasting into the east, eastern radio and television broadcasting into west. Of course, more people watched Western television in the east than watched Eastern television in the west. Yeah, but you could watch both. Yeah, it wasn't like you didn't get access to that. You had access. The only place that didn't have access was Dresden, right next to the Czech border. But otherwise, you had access to all of the Western propaganda from day one of Eastern Germany. The mood began to change. Sections of the demonstrations began to say Germany, one fatherland. And it's in those conditions that Chancellor Kohl began to lean on that mood. He was the conservative Chancellor of West Germany, who lent on the mood in order to galvanise support for himself, because he was very unpopular in West Germany at the time. There was about 3 million unemployed in West Germany at that time. And the East German bureaucracy basically collapsed, and everything was on the street. Everything was basically determined on the streets. There weren't really many strikes at that time. One of the reasons was because people felt that it would undermine the state. They thought there was that fragility. One was because a lot of people were leaving every week. Around 3,000 people would leave, sometimes 3,000 a day, but eventually it got down to about 3,000 a week. But even 3,000 skilled workers out of perhaps 10 million total workers was quite a big deal, particularly if you've got, you know, state industries. These are not private industries. You've got state industries. If the cooks leave, you've got no food. You know, if the, you know, one of the chief engineers leave, the whole factory might be paralysed. And so consequence of that was that there was this feeling that they had to protect on the industrial infrastructure, hoping that then investment would come. Sections hoped that investment would come from the west. Other sections hoped they could change the east. But of course, particularly because the border was just literally like this, you know, the tendency towards looking toward, well, why don't we just, you know, bring back the capitalists and get them, that without saying it in those words, that was effectively a sort of a mood which began to dominate a large section of the population, probably the majority, to be quite honest, and probably the majority were in favour of that by January 1990. The old parties of the East, which were bloc parties which were supposed to be part of the anti-fascist coalition, the Christian Democrats, the Liberal Democrats, the Free Democrats, Christian Democrats, Liberal Democrats, National Democrats, and the Socialist Unity Party. These parties all advocated some form of independent development, as did the New Forum. But that began to change about November, December 1989, January 1989. The parties with the same name as the Western parties got taken over by the Western parties. I mean, it was literally as simple as that. Even though they had officially been communist parties, they just jumped ship. And someone like Merkel, for example, the Chancellor of Germany today, Christian Democrat, she joined the movement in December 1989. So after the movement had died down, she joined it as part of the westernization process. So the West came in with the money, fitted an office out with computers. She joined the party to become an apparatchik, if you like, in this process towards unification. In March 1990, the Christian Democrats won the elections, not a majority, but they won the elections. The Social Democrats and Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats is a new party. The Social Democrats came out of the East, but then rapidly was assimilated by the Western Party. They had money, television time, and all the rest of it, obviously through the Western side. So that played a decisive role in shifting the mood inside the population. They won a majority and advocated two steps toward German unification. One was monetary union, and then there was political union. Monetary union was to be a way of stabilising the society. Originally, what they proposed was that they would give Easterners some money, some West German money. 500 marks would be given to every East German. They would be able to travel to the West, go on holiday in the summer to where they'd never been before, and then they would gradually, over many, many years, unify the country. But by the late spring 1990, they advocated monetary union on the basis of changing all the money in East Germany for West German money, replacing East German money with West German money, which they did on the 1st of July 1990. They basically whirred into town with a lot of a load of armoured trucks and changed all the money into West German money. They changed it at a rate of 1 to 1, which meant people got a lot of money. Better said, they got a lot of purchasing power for goods which they previously couldn't purchase. But it also meant that the entire industry of East Germany was bankrupt, which basically meant that half the population made unemployed within 2 years. So now in 1992, half the population had been made unemployed. And even to this day, many, many areas of East Germany are 20, 30% unemployment. And then political union meant that the entire law, legal structure, and administration of West Germany took over East Germany on the 3rd of October 1990. So East Germany was effectively colonized, although obviously a lot of people felt it was not colonization because they felt themselves to be German and so on and so forth, you know. That mood against that, if you like, came afterwards, once they felt that the economy had collapsed and so on, there began to be a certain sense of colonization, although not everybody has that feeling. All the property, of course, in East Germany was transferred into what's called the Treuhand, and also first they gave it back to those people who previously owned the property. So in many cases it was former Nazis got the properties back, or the Nazi family, if you like. Yeah? The Treuhand, which was basically an organization which took control of the ownership of the property of the state, they privatized, basically gave the companies away to foreigners or West German companies. So 98% of East Germany is now owned by West Germans or by foreigners, which obviously leads to a certain discontent on the part of the population, which is reflected in the vote for the left party, the discontent, but also in a certain, you know, certain some areas where there's a lumpenization in a certain reactionary mood, you know, certain layers of the Nazis and that sort of thing do get a certain base in amongst youth in some more deprived areas of Eastern Germany. So that's about it. Thank you.